Good day, and welcome to the Back to Work series, Showdown Between Congress and the President conference call. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Ms. Kara Stein. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. As Carrie just said, I'm Kara Stein. I'm the Vice President of Policy Development and Programming here at ACS. I want to thank you for joining the third and final call in ACS's Back to Work series, which focuses on the prospects for progress in Congress this fall. Just by way of reminder, our first call dealt with immigration reform and the second one with the judicial vacancy crisis. And all three calls were recorded and are available, will be available on our members-only page on the ACS website. As we enter the second week of a government shutdown, today's call entitled Showdown Between Congress and the President could not be more timely. Our speaker, Peter Shane, will address a number of current instances in which the scope of executive authority is called into question, either in the face of congressional obstruction or in response to presidential assertions of power. From the controversy over raising the debt limit to the case pending in the Supreme Court challenging the president's recess appointment powers, these questions continue to surface, and how they are answered will have tremendous impact on how our government does, or perhaps does not, function. To lead us through the discussion, we have a true expert on the subject. Peter Shane is the Jacob E. Davis and Jacob E. Davis II Chair in Law at Ohio State University's Morris College of Law, where he teaches courses in administrative law, constitutional law, legislation and regulation, and separation of powers law. Most relevant, perhaps, to today's discussion, he was previously an attorney in the Office of Legal Counsel during the Carter administration and was in that office at the time interbranch negotiations were concluding regarding the enactment of FISA and for the drafting of the Attorney General opinions on the Anti-Deficiency Act that launched the modern era of government shutdown. He is co-author of what is still the only law school casebook on separation of powers law and the author of the 2009 book, Madison's Nightmare, How Executive Power Threatens American Democracy. Before I turn it over to Peter, just a couple of logistics. He will offer remarks for about 15 to 20 minutes, and then we'll take your questions. At that time, the operator will instruct you about how to ask a question. And if you're a member of the media, please identify the outlet you represent. And one last thing, Cal, we have been approved for 0.5 credits of California CLE. So if there were instructions in the announcement of this call, but if you need additional assistance, please email my colleague Nick Alexiou at nalexiou, which is A-L-E-X-I-O-U, at acslaw.org. Now I will turn it over to Peter.
Thank you, Kara. Let me start by saying two things. One is it's a real privilege to have been asked to do this, and I plan to speak for certainly no more than 15 minutes, in part because I think the questions and answers are always the most interesting. But that leads me to the second thing, and that is I woke up this morning with a sore throat, thus proving Murphy's Law in the world of conference calls. So I'm going to try to do this with a minimum of throat clearing and water drinking, but I apologize in advance for any such noises. To get to the substance of this, I mean, I take the question before us is what options are available to the president when Congress either cannot or refuses to act in some policy domain. The obvious starting point here is that as a legal matter, of course, the president may rely only on powers that are vested directly in the president by the Constitution or given to him by statutes that previous Congresses have enacted. And the previous Congress's statutes are especially important because the president, as we know, has nearly no unilateral policy-making or policy-implementing authority in domestic affairs under Article II. He can set managerial priorities for the executive branch. There are some kinds of discretion that he can exercise that are significant. But he cannot issue rules, for example, that bind the public in any particular policy domain without some prior legislative authority. So if you look, you can see this if you compare a couple of areas in which Congress has been unable or refused to act, like climate change on one hand or gun control and cybersecurity on the other hand. In climate change, where previous Congresses enacted the Clean Air Act and its amendments, the Environmental Protection Agency has binding rulemaking authority that the administration can proceed to implement in ways that significantly move the ball on carbon dioxide regulation because they have the legislative authority to do so. When Congress could not reach a collective outcome on either cybersecurity or gun control, President Obama did issue memorandums and executive orders to kind of stake out his positions in these two areas. But those memorandums or executive orders were either hortatory or really priority setting within the executive branch, but they didn't actually require anyone in the public to do anything. And I suppose the one other introductory thing I would just say is that obviously what he may do as a matter of law, insofar as we can figure out what that is not necessarily the same thing as what he will do or what he should do as a matter of policy or institutional politics. So I want to devote most of my talk, obviously, to the debt ceiling on one hand and the kind of impasse over appointments on the other. And I'll talk about the debt ceiling first, although there, of course, are other areas where the president might wish Congress to act and it's not happening, but these are clearly what's on people's minds predominantly. So let's start with the debt ceiling. And I'd like to catalog and at least say a brief word about five ways out of this dilemma that have been discussed. The differences between some of them may be rather subtle, but I think I've identified five possible ways out if Congress really does nothing by October 17th. And the problem, of course, with any of these options is that if the president announces early on, and by early on I mean with more than 60 seconds to go, that he has a way out, it will have the simultaneous effect of removing pressure on Congress to act because the president will have declared that there's a way out, and also set himself up for kind of the maximum congressional pushback. You know, there are members of Congress who have said that they would love to see President Obama impeached if they could just figure out something impeachable. And so, you know, that's part of the political backdrop to this. But also I think the president is rightly going to be worried that if he suggests that he could take responsibility for a solution, then this could significantly undermine whatever pressure does exist for Congress actually doing its job. So that having been said, the five options that occur to me would be as follows. So one is the trillion-dollar Klein option, which people have undoubtedly read about, the idea that the Treasury Department could simply use its statutorily apparently unlimited authority to mint new coins to create a coin that will have a face value of $1 trillion, put it in the federal government's account at the Fed, and just pay off our debts with the proceeds. I think one thing to be said, of course, is that the White House has repudiated this option. I do think it fails the too cute by half test in the sense that no one thinks that the authority to mint coins was created in order to allow the Treasury to affect our money supply. This is entirely to create commemorative coins. And I generally think that in thinking about institutionally responsible options, my own prejudice, for what it's worth, is against innovations that, again, just seem to be kind of too cute by half in the sense that nobody would have intended this mechanism to be used in this particular circumstance. A second possibility is the 14th Amendment option. This is the argument that begins with the premise, the undeniable premise, that the 14th Amendment does state that the public debt of the United States is not to be called into question. It's been vigorously and certainly intelligently urged by, especially by my colleague and old friend Garrett Epps, who writes for The Atlantic and is a law professor at the University of Baltimore, that the president might rely on this clause of the 14th Amendment to say that failing to raise the debt ceiling is a violation of this congressional obligation, and he is therefore not obligated as president to respect the debt ceiling. And Garrett has, I think, an important historical argument that, in a sense, we know that this phrase was added to the 14th Amendment to prevent former citizens of the Confederacy from being elected to Congress, and based on their opposition to the very existence of the federal government, repudiating debts incurred in order to keep the Union together. I mean, one could make the argument that that's sort of what's going on now in a historically analogous way. But again, I would say, first of all, the White House has said they're not going to rely on the 14th Amendment. In the 14th Amendment, I guess my own view is that the 14th Amendment really is worded as a command to Congress. It's not worded as an empowering of the president. I would be somewhat reluctant to rely on this if I were counseling the president for that reason. A third way out, I guess, would be some kind of prioritization. That is, and this would work only if we could avoid default by shutting down enough other government spending so that we could free up enough money to pay off bondholders. I don't actually know mathematically whether that is possible, but the thought would be that the Impoundment Control Act allows the president to recommend deferrals of appropriated spending to achieve savings or otherwise, the statute says, to provide for contingencies. And those deferrals take effect unless Congress legislates to overturn them. And, of course, the president could veto legislation to overturn the deferral. So he could basically defer the spending of money until the end of the fiscal year in order to use that money to pay off our creditors. Of course, exercising his deferral authority in this way would be deeply ironic. It would require the president to make decisions as to what kinds of appropriated spending he could diminish or cut off altogether. And the whole point of the Impoundment Control Act was to prevent presidents from doing that very thing. Congress in 1974 was intent on not allowing presidents after the Nixon presidency from arguing that they could use the Impoundment Control Act to impose their own policy preferences with regard to what functions to fund and which not to. So that's, I suppose, possible, but as I said, would be deeply ironic and would sort of surprise the drafters of the Impoundment Control Act. A fourth argument that's been offered by Eric Posner from the University of Chicago is that the president could simply claim that he has emergency power under the vesting clause of Article II and for reasons of state in order to basically save the republic from itself, so to speak, he would ignore the debt ceiling in order to maintain the American and indeed the global economy from the effects of a default-induced meltdown. That's a coherent argument. The executive power, however, the vesting clause in Article II has never been given very definitive content by the Supreme Court, and one worries about an argument that is quite that open-ended. My own preference would therefore be for the fifth option, which I call the faithful execution option. And the argument here would be that failing to raise the debt ceiling really leaves the president with two irreconcilable demands. It's as if he'd been told both that he should not drive any vehicle faster than 45 miles per hour, but he should also drive no vehicle slower than 60 miles an hour. So he can't do both. He can't be faster than 60 and slower than 45. And he's in this position because the appropriations laws are really demands that he spend money in designated amounts for particular purposes, and the debt ceiling purports to be a limit on how much he can borrow. But if there's a shortfall in taxes, then he cannot keep faith with Congress's spending wishes and at the same time respect its debt ceiling. So my argument would be that he should interpret appropriations as applying the authority in the president as an agent of Congress to continue borrowing as much money as is necessary, but not a dollar more, that is necessary to fulfill his obligation to maintain federal spending at the limits that that Congress has already set. This argument, I think, has also been made by Michael Dorff and his co-author in an article. But the analogy here would be to a case like Midwest Oil from the earliest part of the 20th century, where Congress had basically said to the president by statute that he was not to prevent the private oil or mineral exploitation of public lands. But President Taft did that anyway, thinking that if he didn't, then the removal of oil from public lands would make it more difficult for the government to pay for that oil should we wind up going to war. And the Supreme Court upheld that because they said that as Congress's agent, the president had some power to maintain the status quo in order to prevent a disaster that Congress perhaps had not contemplated. Anyway, so that's the fifth option. So I've already taken almost 13 minutes on that, so let me just say something about recess appointments. The case before the Supreme Court right now is called Noel Canning versus the NLRB, and it has to do with the constitutionality of recess appointments that were made on January 4th of 2012 for three members of the NLRB. And as everybody on the call probably knows, this occurred between two pro forma sessions of Congress that were held pursuant to a Senate unanimous consent order that said that the Senate would get together, and by get together they mean one senator would show up every 3 days, to call the Senate to order and then adjourn it. It was doing this because the House of Representatives refused to allow the Senate to adjourn for more than 3 days, and this was actually invented as a technique by Harry Reid to prevent recess appointments by the Bush administration. OLC, under the Bush administration, apparently told President Bush that he didn't have to fall for this. He could make recess appointments, notwithstanding the every three-day sessions. But the president decided not to challenge it. And now President Obama did. He made these appointments to the NLRB so that it would have enough members to function, notwithstanding the Senate's sitting on a number of these nominees for nearly a year. As it happens, both the Third and Fourth Circuits have held Craig Becker's 2010 appointment during a recess impermissible on the ground that it was an intra-session recess appointment. The Third Circuit has stayed any action on a petition for rehearing until the D.C. Circuit case is decided. The Fourth Circuit just itself denied rehearing on September 5th, so I assume that the government's going to petition for cert in that case, or at least petition for a stay, so that Noel Canning will be decided first. There are at least half a dozen analytically possible ways for the D.C. Circuit to be handled in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court could agree with the D.C. Circuit that intra-session recess appointments are impermissible, categorically. The only recess appointments allowable would be between sessions of the Senate, not during sessions of the Senate. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that they could say that even though intra-session appointments might be permissible, that they're not permissible unless the intra-session period of adjournment was fairly long. The 3 days didn't qualify, so that the recess appointments on January 4th were invalid for that reason. They could actually uphold the appointments on the ground that this particular intra-session appointment was the de facto equivalent of an intersession appointment because the break between mid-December and mid-January was effectively an intersession break. That's been suggested by Mike Davidson, a former counsel to the Senate. It could basically uphold intra-session appointments in general and just say that the three-day business was just ineffective to prevent the president from using his intra-session recess appointments power because the Senate was really not made available during those sessions, and therefore it was not a three-day break. It was a 20-day break. A fifth possibility is that they could say that intra-session appointments are permissible categorically. It doesn't matter whether the Senate is away for 3 days or 3 hours or 3 minutes. Or finally, and this is actually my own recommendation, they could avoid ruling on the merits, holding either that this is a political question or that there's no injury caused by the recess appointments in this case that would give rise to standing. But the question is, what would the president do if somehow or other, whatever the outcome of this case is, even if the Supreme Court does not agree with the reasoning of the D.C. Circuit, what happens if the Supreme Court says intra-session recess appointments are not going to be permitted under the Constitution? I think it should be noted that among recent presidents, President Obama has actually been the least active recess appointer. He has not really done this very much. But if he were intent on doing this, he could simply make massive numbers of intercession appointments. He could do this simply by preparing a bunch of documents that make the appointment, the recess appointments, effective the moment the gavel comes down that ends the next session of the Senate, even if the break between the first session and the second session of the Senate is a nanosecond. Theodore Roosevelt actually did this, I think, in 1903, which caused a great furor, but they were legally unchallenged. President Obama could do that. There's no requirement that an intercession appointment be of any particular length, as long as the letter says this is effective upon the recess of the first session of the Senate. It seems to me there's no problem. And if the president wanted to be yet more aggressive, he could force the adjournment of the Senate with the help of Harry Reid. That is, he could ask the Senate to adjourn sine die, and if the Democrats want to do that, but the House won't go along, then the president could use his power under Article II to compel the adjournment of Congress if the two houses don't agree on a date for adjournment. And he could create an intercession space during which he could make appointments. This would be a real escalation, a real further breakdown in interbranch norms of comity, that's C-O-M-I-T-Y, not comedy, insofar as those norms still exist. Whether President Obama would be inclined to do that, it's hard to say. There are lots of disincentives for the president politically to engage in that kind of action, but we are in unprecedented times, in a way, in terms of interbranch warfare, at least unprecedented in the post-Reconstruction era. Who knows? But those options are all available, and they're literally available under the text of the Constitution. So I've talked for almost 20 minutes. Why don't I stop there and open this up for some dialogue?
Thanks, Peter. Carrie, could you give instructions about queuing up for questions?
Certainly. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, it is star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment.
While we're waiting for folks to queue up, I actually did receive a handful of questions in advance of the call, so maybe I'll shoot one out to you now, Peter. One question was, what trends have you seen, if any, emerging in the use of executive power over the last decade or so? And more specifically, how has the Supreme Court approached executive power over this period, I guess with an eye towards the Noel Canning case?
Well, so let me actually take the second question first. This Supreme Court has generally been largely protective of, solicitous of executive power. I suppose the Guantanamo cases are an exception to that, but certainly, Justices Scalia, Roberts, and Alito, in a variety of contexts, both on and off the court, have been very strong defenders of executive power. And this is going to be an interesting case in part of that, because I assume that none of those justices is particularly eager to hand the Obama administration a victory with regard to the NLRB or anything. But I do think they would readily perceive that shutting down the recess appointments power, especially on the broad grounds that the D.C. Circuit argued, would significantly weaken the institutional presidency. So I think this would be a real hard one for them. With regard to trends in executive power, I mean, the trend is always upward. The question is whether there's an acceleration or not. President Obama has arguably done a number of things, particularly in domestic affairs, that at least rhetorically have tried to scale back the claims of executive power that were made by prior administrations. But these things have almost always been done through his own kind of unilateral discretionary action, which means that for example, if the president says, I'm not going to claim a FOIA exemption unless the agency can articulate an actual public interest that would be compromised in addition to claiming a technical violation of a technical claim under one of the FOIA exemptions. I mean, that's a lovely policy, but no future president is required to follow it. So I think, you know, the trend has been towards greater unilateralism. The Obama administration is much more reluctant to claim direct authority under the Constitution than the Bush administration. But, you know, in a lot of respects, Congress, through the statutes it has already enacted, has given the president plenty of authority to act without this current Congress going along. So, you know, the net outcome is executive power is still a good bet.
We also got a handful of questions about immigration. And
I'm sorry.
To immigration and the president's decision to defer deportation of certain young people who are brought to the U.S. as minors and who are who do not have legal immigration status. And the questions were about your view of that DACA program in the context of an executive power conversation and what options might be available to the president if Congress fails to pass immigration reform.
Yeah, I think my own view is that what is currently happening is kind of consistent with my understanding of the constitutional and administrative law, but the president really doesn't have much room to go further. I mean, it's accepted by, I think, everyone that the president, with regard to any kind of prosecutorial function that the executive branch has, and I'm using the word prosecutorial very broadly, not just with regard to criminal prosecutions, he has the discretion to, the executive branch has the discretion to set enforcement priorities. The only, I guess the novel thing about the Napolitano order is that it covers a lot of cases through an express policy rather than adjudicating each case on a case-by-case basis. But I think it's certainly arguable, and I would argue that if the department knows that as a matter of priority setting, it's always going to regard cases like this as being of less priority than you know, cases involving adult felons and so forth, that it does the public a service by announcing its prosecutorial policies in advance. It certainly exposes itself to much more intense public and congressional oversight. So I think that's all fine. But I think the president, any president, has to be careful about using, you know, a plausible claim of prosecutorial discretion in a way that seems to be simply posing resistance to the underlying statute. And I think the president has said as much with regard to the immigration statute. So I don't know how much more priority setting he could do in quite the way the Napolitano order functions that would accomplish some of what you know, the immigration reform statute would accomplish. He certainly couldn't increase penalties on employers as a way of rationalizing enforcement. He couldn't. And even the Napolitano order, you know, doesn't render the people who benefit from it non-deportable as a matter of law. It just says that the department's not going to proceed against them as a matter of policy, and that policy could be changed by a subsequent president.
And the last set of questions I received in advance had to do with foreign policy, which I guess is a demonstration of how broadly this larger conversation of executive power reaches across domestic to international issues. But specifically, the question was, do you think that President Obama needed congressional approval in order to take action in Syria?
Well, of course, you know, there's no authoritative legal precedent to cite on this. Presidents since World War II have claimed unilateral authority to deploy military force wherever they want in the name of U.S. national security. I think in its broadest form, that claim is probably not sustainable. My own reading of the Constitution is that the deployment of military force does require congressional authorization, but I do think congressional authorization can come in a variety of implied and delegated forms. It doesn't always have to be spelled out in every detail. And so if the president were to make a claim that he has authority implied from Congress to engage in a short-term military strike. That's not a frivolous claim. What was different about Syria, though, is that it would be very hard to point to a good precedent in terms of congressional acquiescence in a short-term military strike for these particular purposes. That is, this is a strike against Syria would not involve, the direct protection of American persons or property. It would not be carrying out a UN resolution. It would not be in pursuit of maintaining some other international alliance like NATO, whose coherence might depend on our action. It really would be a factually different kind of situation. And I think the president, even if he was not, even if there was an argument that he was not required to turn to Congress, I think his prudence in doing so was considerable because, with regard to an initiative that really lacked any kind of close historical precedent, the president would have been potentially been expanding executive power further than even he would want to go by staking out the authority to engage in this kind of action without both branches being involved. Now, that raises the question, okay, now that he's asked Congress, if Congress had taken a vote and said no, would he be bound? And my own answer, I think, is yes. I think the president probably did put himself in a situation where had Congress taken a vote and were that vote negative, it would be very hard to say that he still had unilateral authority to proceed against Syria. But I accept that that's a debatable conclusion.
Okay, thanks. Well, so, Kerry, I don't see any additional questions in the queue. I guess people took advantage of sending them to me in advance. Do you have anything else?
I don't.
Okay. So with that, Peter, I want to thank you for a great we just got one. I see. Someone have a question?
We'll take our first question from David Gorn.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Peter, I'd like to see if you have a recommendation for a book. I have Arthur J. Schlesinger's Imperial Presidency, but it stops maybe in the 80s. Do you have a recommendation for something that's given a good picture of how the Article II powers have been expanded by more recent presidencies?
Well, first let me say I didn't plant that question. I published a book in 2009 called Madison's Nightmare, How Executive Power Threatens American Democracy. It's published by University of Chicago Press. I'm now thinking of a companion volume called Madison's Other Nightmare, How Congressional Irresponsibility Threatens American Democracy, but that's not out yet. But seriously, my 2009 book does try to explain the trajectory of increased executive power from the Reagan administration through the second Bush administration. I think, there's a lot of good writing in this area. And, I could also recommend, although it's not quite on point, but really I think one of the best analyses of the Bush administration from an insider is The Terror Presidency by Jack Goldsmith. I recommend that very highly. Anyway, if you forgive the plug, that's my recommendation.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
As a reminder, it is star one if you would like to ask a question.
Can I mention one other impasse just to give people 30 seconds to ask a question if they want?
Please.
People may have noticed that U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia last week held that it did have jurisdiction over the House of Representatives suit against Eric Holder over the documents that were held with regard to Fast and Furious. I could explain this at length, but I won't unless asked. But this is an executive privilege fight over documents with regard to the nature of Department of Justice deliberations about how to respond to Congress regarding its demand for documents. And my guess there is that I don't know how. I mean, all the court has done is that they've rejected the executive branch argument that they lack jurisdiction. They haven't decided on the merits. I would expect that the executive branch will persist in its resistance, in part because it wouldn't perceive any downside to doing so, and the litigation can possibly be resolved prior to the seating of the next Congress. So, you know, might as well see how the House of Representatives election turns out in 2014. But there's another impasse for your catalog.
Well, I just want to thank you, Peter, so much for outlining a complicated subject, but one that is clearly on all of our minds. And I want to thank everyone for joining and remind you that this conversation was recorded, so if you have any friends who missed it, they can access it on the ACS website through our membership-only portal. And we look forward to future conversations with both Peter and all of you. But thanks so much. Thanks, Carrie.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you once again. That does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation.